Well, I absolutely love the book. It's a powerful read, and learned so much about what has gone on over the last 6 decades here. It's been a long fight, and one that's far from being over.
That is so true. And, you know, I have worked on climate change issues for over 20 years, and I didn't even know that the history went back to LBJ. That was mind-blowing for me. I thought, oh, you know, I know that when Al Gore was elected in the 70s, that he was already into this, the idea of doing something about climate change. And I knew that that in the 90s, I mean, I didn't even know there was so much activity in the 80s. It was a very pleasant surprise, actually, because some senators that I had the pleasure of working with were deeply engaged in the 80s. And I didn't even know that at the time that I was working with them. So, yeah, it was kind of mind-blowing to think about LBJ in 1965 hearing this briefing about how if we continued to release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, unfettered as we were and still are, that by the 21st century, we would be experiencing greater storms with more frequency and intensity, wildfires, droughts, basically all the things we're seeing right now. And he was worried and so did what worried presidents do and commissioned a study. And of course, that study ended up on some shelf somewhere, as most studies do. But yeah, really, really long battle. And, you know, I'll give Congress and policymakers this. In the beginning, they didn't know what to do, right? They knew they had to reduce greenhouse gases. They knew, especially carbon dioxide emissions, they weren't sure how much. Was it a 20% reduction, a 50% reduction? And they were acting in an abundance of caution, right? They wanted to make sure that whatever policy mechanism that they put into place was the right thing to do. And by the time they figured out what that was, well, then the oil and gas folks had sort of caught up with the idea that, we can prevent any of this policy from happening with a very simple playbook that's still used today, Rich. They cast doubt in the science and stoke fears about increased energy prices. And so they haven't really had to tweak that playbook much over the last few decades, but it made it increasingly hard to pass climate legislation, even when you had an abundance of will.
And as you mentioned, President Johnson was the first to bring it to the public's attention in 1965. But am I right that the polluters themselves knew about it even before that, or at least suspected it?
Sure thing. They knew in the 50s. I mean, there's some accounts that go back to even the 19th century, right? People who studied trends. And I think a great way to put this for your listeners is that, you know, there is a distinction between weather and climate. So I hear this all the time. The weathermen cannot accurately predict what's going to happen tomorrow. So how can they tell us that the climate is warming? And I had a meteorologist a few years ago say that the analogy he uses is that weather is one down in a play in a single football game, and climate is the entire history of the NFL. So when you are looking at climate, it's a great sports analogy, right? I love a sports analogy. So climate change, you know, looking at those trends and the year-on-year trends, and when you see the visual graph of how much our carbon pollution has increased since the Industrial Revolution, when we really started manufacturing and then later when we started driving vehicles and so forth, it is pretty startling. And so, yes, especially in the 50s, a lot of the science was really gelling in the 50s. And it wasn't just the government scientists. The oil and gas company scientists saw it too. And they weren't as nefarious back then. You didn't really see that shift in the posture of the oil companies until kind of the late 80s, early 90s, when they got new leadership. And the new leadership said, you know, we have to engage that playbook that I mentioned. But yeah, it was really, you know, all the scientists were in agreement, as they are today. 99.9% of the climate scientists, I should say, agree that this is happening. And so, we've come a long way. And when you look at the polling today, 3/4 of Americans accept the science of climate change. I don't like to say believe, right? Because there's a prominent climate scientist named Dr. Catherine Hayhoe who says, you know, whether or not you believe in gravity, if you jump off a building, you're going down. And it's sort of the same. Climate change doesn't care whether you believe in it, it's happening. But accepting the science of climate change, and 3/4 of Americans do and think the federal government should do something about it. And they have. They have in the last, you know, in 2022, the first really big bill passed that included, you know, almost $500 billion in investment in clean energy. And it's, as far as, I like to think of it as not even a down payment, it's sort of make-up payments for several years of inaction between 2016 and 2020, and then the years of inaction before that when you just had kind of stalemates in Congress. It's not the last word that the U.S. government should have. You know, I hope that we will continue to see progress made, and eventually I'd love to see a price on carbon. We have to cap those emissions. It's one thing to incentivize all that wonderful clean energy that is out there. And hey, nuclear has to be part of the picture too. But we also need to be figuring out how to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. We keep generating power, as we are with AI and data centers, a huge energy vampires, then we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to be reducing. It isn't enough to just make more. We're going to have to reduce the use of the fossil fuels that we are using. So
we're talking with Chelsea Henderson. Her new book is called Glacial, The Inside Story of Climate Politics. Fascinating to look back on the history of this. And I knew when I have talked about Nixon was a guy who might not fit in today's Republican Party because he started the EPA. What I didn't know is that he was, as you put it, a bit of a reluctant environmentalist. And it was the work of Democrat Daniel Patrick Moynihan that really pushed him in that direction.
Yeah, you know, Nixon was a really interesting figure. You can't work on environmental issues in Washington, D.C. like I do and not know and acknowledge that Nixon signed into law not only the creation of the EPA, which he did, by the way, after in the same year that you saw Woodstock and the first Earth Day, these young movements of younger people, right, were happening. And so creating the EPA was kind of his nod to, I hear you, I see you, I'm not going to go to Woodstock and I'm not going to go to Earth Day, but I will do this thing. And it made sense, right? We should have one federal agency that is the purveyor of all things environmental. But he also signed into law the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And he created the Council on Environmental Quality. So he did a lot in his short time. But he was a guy who really didn't think that you needed a president for domestic issues. And that fascinated me. He thought the president's job was foreign policy. That was his bailiwick. That's what he wanted to focus on. So what he did was he hired really super competent advisors, surrounded himself with advisors who had experience, who were, you know, well-regarded in their circles. And then he took their advice, right? When they came to him and said, we should do this, we should do that, he valued their opinion. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan, very big liberal, couldn't have been farther than Nixon, apart from Nixon on the spectrum, political spectrum. Was someone he admired. And what he thought was interesting about Moynihan is that Moynihan had worked for Johnson, LBJ, and had helped with the Johnson had several social reforms during his tenure. And he thought that Moynihan could sort of see where some of the fault lines were and some of the failures were. And so they could help kind of evolve them and improve them through his administration. But Moynihan was the guy that first kind of thought, this climate change thing, which they didn't call climate change back then. They called it the greenhouse effect. So think about going into a greenhouse, right? It feels warm and steamy. That's kind of what we're doing to the earth. He wrote a memo actually to John Ehrlichman, another guy
right.
who didn't think would be exonerated in my book. And I'm not trying to exonerate him for his crimes, but he was a prominent Seattle environmental attorney before he came to the Nixon administration. And he was a huge advocate as well for some of this the environmental legacy that Nixon has today.
So interesting to see figures and, well, relatives of figures who keep coming up in our history over the last 40 or 50 years. Jimmy Carter had put solar panels up on the White House. Ronald Reagan took them down and then appointed a woman named Ann Gorsuch. If the name sounds familiar, it's because her son is on the Supreme Court, and she was named head of the Environmental Protection Agency and was, I guess, is it safe to say, the Scott Pruitt of her time?
She was definitely the Scott Pruitt of her time. She didn't last long. Morale was low. I was not in D.C. at that period of time. I was definitely... had my pom-poms out at Old Town High School and had other thoughts on my mind. But, much like under Scott Pruitt's tenure, I had friends that were career employees at EPA. So at all federal agencies, for those listeners who don't know, you have two types of employees. You have, we call them career employees. And these are really the experts, right? They might be a chemist or an economist, or, they have the, often have doctorate degrees and advanced experience in their field, and they are the ones that take the policy that Congress writes, and they implement it using their expertise. So you have the career employees and you have the political appointees, and political appointees shift with every administration. So when a Democrat comes in, they bring in their people. A Republican comes in, most of the career people will change. If you are going Democrat to Democrat or Republican to Republican, some of those appointees might stay or go to a higher position. But the career employees' morale is really low under Ann Gorsuch's reign. And so then they gave the EPA back to the guy that had run it in the first place. Bill Ruckelshaus had been the first EPA administrator when Nixon first created the agency. And he came back and he restored that morale. And Scott Pruitt, it was the same. My friends who were career employees were, it was really the first time that they had felt in their career like somebody wasn't taking their advice or listening to their counsel, and probably to the benefit of the environment, because the EPA lost a lot of his lawsuits when he was, he wanted to dismantle. He wasn't trying to protect the statutes. He was trying to kind of take them the other way. And a lot of his suits failed because they weren't backed by the science. He wasn't listening to these career experts.
Well, speaking of that, I want to jump ahead a little bit and just get your opinion. What will be the likely impact of this recent decision by the Supreme Court that essentially serves to gut the power of agencies like the EPA and experts and say, oh, no, the Supreme Court is better suited to make decisions about these things than those people who have actually spent years learning about it and working on legislation?
Yeah, Rich, you're so right. That Chevron deference decision by the Supreme Court, not covered in the book because it happened after we had already gone to print, but huge impacts on policy. And really, that Chevron case was what allowed us to have this federal government, and not just the EPA, right? EPA was an agency that used it a lot, but that allowed the experts in all the federal agencies to ensure that the policies that Congress is passing are implemented in the right way. So if you think about who's in Congress, right, who is writing these bills, I would say, this is not scientific at all, but 80-ish% are probably lawyers, right? Some small percent are teachers and doctors, but we don't have a lot of economists. We don't have a lot of environmentalists, right? We don't have a lot of public health experts. So when you think about Congress creating policy, and then you're no longer going to have that deference to the people who actually have the expertise when it comes to implementing that policy, it's going to be, we're going to see some pretty dramatic effects. It'll be interesting to see what happens, obviously, after the election and moving forward. But that it was always kind of backstop, right? So you knew that the Clean Water Act was not going to evolve because of something that happened outside of the agency. But here we are. Power grab. In two words, it's a heap by the Supreme Court.
Chelsea Henderson's new book is called Glacial, The Inside Story of Climate Politics. There was a time when at least belief in climate change was bipartisan in many ways, but that turned, particularly in the 90s, and you talk in the book about the role of Frank Luntz in sowing those seeds of doubt.
Yeah, so you kind of saw it happening a little bit in after the 1994 Republican Revolution. So Clinton and Gore were in the White House in the midterm election in 94. Republicans took control of both chambers of Congress for the first time in something like 40 or 50 years, and then went on this rampage, right, to roll back all regulations. And at that point, you started to see the environment lose a little bit of its bipartisan spirit. You still had some good old-fashioned moderate Republicans, right, who were fighting the fight. And you know, what's interesting, Rich, is that before this point, environmental issues didn't fall so much along party lines. They fell upon regional lines.
Right.
So the Northeast, long-time stalwart for climate, or for, sorry, environmental protection. And then you had the Midwest, where we make things, right, where they were emitting a lot of pollutants into the atmosphere. And Mainers, certainly older generations will remember the acid rain problem that we had in the 70s and 80s. The winds from the Midwest carrying all those pollutants, blowing those clouds over to us, and then any precipitation coming down, you know, decimating our forests and our rivers and affecting fish and livelihoods. So you had a real shift in the 90s away from environmental issues being looked at through this regional lens and instead being looked at from, you know, sort of party purity. And then in 2000, you know, what's interesting is in the 2000 debate between Gore and Bush, the second President Bush, first President Bush ran on solving climate change, by the way. Second President Bush didn't like the Kyoto Protocol so much, but said, hey, we're gonna cut greenhouse gas emissions. That was a campaign promise that he made. And then when he did win the White House, his pollster, Frank Luntz, was like, okay, you won. You kind of won because some, you know, this is me speaking, not Frank Luntz, but some shady things happened in Florida, right? And those hanging chads and the votes cast for Pat Buchanan by accident, the terrible recount, all of that. But, you know, Bush declared the winner, comes in, and Frank Luntz is like, you have real image problem, Republicans. And one of the concerns that he had was that Republicans were seen as uncaring and in particular, you know, unfriendly to the environment. And you would think that what he was trying to say is maybe take a different approach to the environment. But instead, what he was saying is we've got to soften the way we talk about the environment. So we're not going to call it global warming, which is, you know, actually a very accurate description of what is happening. The globe is warming. It might not warm at the same rate everywhere. Some places might experience some cooling, but overall, the net, you know, overall global temperature is increasing. We're going to call it climate change because climate change sounds much less scary than global warming. And so he was the one that changed that got a lot of Republicans calling it climate change. Now, the climate scientists were like, okay, it's climate change too. We'll call it that, right? People adapted. And what's funny is that that former President Trump tried to blame Democrats for changing the name from global warming to climate change,
right,
so that they could account for times with, you know, when it snows, which I'm sorry, sometimes it is actually supposed to snow, but he was quite inaccurate in that. That was Frank Luntz, President George W. Bush's pollster, that came up with that plan.
And there are throughout the book, I think, some heroes of the effort, and many of them are Republicans, people like Rhode Island's John Chaffee, John Warner from Virginia, at least for a while, John McCain of Arizona, and of course, the dozens, hundreds of staffers who work so hard behind the scenes.
For sure. You know, one of a reporter I spoke to last week called this book a love letter to congressional staffers, and I'm glad that that is coming through because, you know, having been one, I see how hard people work. They're doing 12, 14, 16-hour days. They're having all their meals at their desk, right? They're just trying so hard to, you know, to draft legislation, to negotiate it with the sides that need to be negotiated with. But, yeah, John McCain is one of my favorites in terms of the champion just because he saw this. This issue was brought to his attention when he was running for president in 2000. He was in New Hampshire, nearby us, I'm going to say, even though I'm not currently in Maine. And all these students were attending the rally, not just his rallies, but all the presidential candidate rallies dressed in superhero costumes. And he finally asked one of the guys to come up, and you know, what do you want? Why are you here? Why are you dressed like this? And the guy said, we want to know your plan for climate change. And McCain said, to get honesty out of a politician, which is such a breath of fresh air, he said, I don't have a plan. And I'm embarrassed that I don't have a plan. I'm sorry, I don't have a plan. I'm going to make a plan. And when he, you know, he went on to win New Hampshire, but then his presidential race petered out that year. And he went back to Washington and used his position as chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over NOAA, which where all the climate scientists live. And he had a bunch of hearings, and he boned up on the issue, and he knew it needed to have a bipartisan effort. And Senator Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, at the time Democrat, later changed his party affiliation to independent. Lieberman had been engaged on the issue for a long time as well, and so the two partnered up and made several attempts to pass a bill. And, you know, McCain did have a moment where he kind of faltered a little when he was being in the 2010 cycle, right after he lost the presidency to Barack Obama. But he got the laugh in a way, because he came back in 2018, 2017, right before he passed away, actually. He cast the deciding vote that prevented the Trump administration from rolling back the methane rule. And the methane rule, so methane is a form of greenhouse gas like carbon dioxide, and it's super potent, and it is emitted when we burn natural gas. And there is a methane rule that had been codified under the Obama administration, and the Trump administration trying to roll it back. And McCain had been pretty, he didn't actually really like the rule, but I think he a little bit wanted to stick it to Trump, and it was a little bit his nod back to his original climate championship. And I watched a lot of C-SPAN footage, I'm embarrassed to say, in writing this book. And it was really fun to watch that scene where he just goes onto the Senate floor and he turns his thumb down, and then a barrage of senators surround him, trying to get him to change his mind. And he breaks through that crowd and just storms right out of the Senate chamber. So you got to be a climate hero one last time.
The story of the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which President Biden wished he had given a different name, and the effort to get West Virginia's Joe Manchin on board, my goodness, it reads like a suspense novel. It's fascinating, and finally got us some legitimate climate legislation. But here we are just a few months away from the election. So I ask you, what are the stakes for the planet in this year's election?
So high, Rich, so high. Vote climate. I mean, people are single issue voters for a lot of things, right? A lot of important issues, but really climate change should be top of your list. Because do you like to eat, right? Climate change, a warming climate, is impacting where we can grow food. Do you like to breathe, right? It's about air quality. It's about water quality, public health. It's an economic issue. We're not maybe seeing it as much in Maine, but a state like Florida, where the home insurance industries have left because it is not profitable for them to insure homes in Florida, and the same is happening in California, a state plagued by wildfires and drought. You can't buy a house without home insurance, right? Banks are inherently conservative. They are not going to give you a mortgage. And that is their asset, right? Until you've paid that mortgage off, it is their asset. They own the asset. They are not going to give you money and hold on to that asset unless it's insured against disaster. So I think we're going to start seeing this happen more, especially along the coasts and in some of the states that are seeing the worst impacts of climate change. So it is across the board. It is not just an environmental issue, economic, health, agricultural. So vote for pro-climate candidates. And at the top of the ticket for the cycle, there's really only one option, and that's Vice President Harris. I think former President Trump sent us way back in his term in 2016 to 2018 or 2020. I tried to shave a few years off after a little PTSD from that era. You know, it was, we were an embarrassment to the rest of the world. You know, when he pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, that put us in the company of only two other nations that hadn't signed on to that agreement. One of them was Nicaragua, which hadn't signed because they didn't think it was strong enough, and Syria, which was embroiled in a civil war. So, you know, how embarrassing on the world stage to be, you know, head in the sand on this. And Project 2025, is that 900-page blueprint from the Heritage Foundation, which would, you know, sort of the wish list, I guess, from the far right of what they would love to see in a Trump administration. They talk about eliminating NOAA, which includes the National Right. Weather Service. Mm. Could you imagine not having the National Weather Service? Like, just these are, you know, insane ideas. And I'm past the point. I've been here long enough where I don't want to say, oh, it's too crazy to happen, right? Because I've seen some crazy happen. And so stopping the crazy from happening, like, and you can vote for climate candidates across the board at local levels. What you do is at locally is important, state level, federal level. Vote for pro-climate candidates and ask them what their solution is. Ask what their plan is. And, you know, you might end up with that reaction that McCain had. There could be somebody that wasn't engaged and who decides to engage if they get asked that question enough.
Well, there are so many fascinating stories, and we didn't get to a number of them, but my goodness, the story of John Sununu, his influence on the first President Bush, the work of Al Gore for many, many years, the role of the Koch brothers, yes, they got their little fingers into this as well, and the huge impact of the Citizens United ruling. It is it's a terrific, fascinating read, brilliantly researched and written as only an insider could do. The book is called Glacial, The Inside Politics, The Inside Story of Climate Politics. Chelsea Henderson, it is wonderful to talk with you. Love the book, and it's so great to catch up with you again.
Thank you, Rich. It was such a pleasure to be on the show and to hopefully reach the ears of my former comrades in Maine. I'm going to come back someday, I promise. I hope to move back to Maine in the next 10 years or so. But a real pleasure to be on your show. Thank you so much for reaching out to me.